Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Thanks for coming along tonight. We put the function on at short notice, and it's great to see so many people here. Thanks to our associate member, Tom Parker, who told us about our speaker tonight. Professor Murray Selby is going to talk on the topic of global emission of carbon dioxide, the contribution from natural sources. And our speaker's career is wide. He's currently chair of climate at the Faculty of Science at Macquarie University, but he's had visiting professorships in Paris and Stockholm, in Jerusalem and Kyoto, and he's spent time in sabbatical at the Bureau of Meteorology in Australia on two occasions. So welcome to Professor Selby talking on global emissions of carbon dioxide. Thank you for coming.
Thank you, Gerard, and thanks to the Sydney Institute and Tom Parker for inviting me. You're aware of the topic, at least in generality. I should tell you that for most of my career of 30 years in atmospheric physics, on this topic, my position was agnostic, like many competent scientists in the field. The findings I'll present were recently unveiled at an international conference. They've compelled me and others in the scientific community to rethink that position. In view of the public debate on carbon dioxide, the Australian community should have the benefit of these findings now, while they're relevant. Much of the debate surrounds human emission by Australia in relation to other countries. But what matters physically isn't emission. It's carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. That's what influences the Earth's temperature. The debate has been obsessed with emission because the presumption is that observed changes of CO2 are due exclusively to human emission. In reality, atmospheric CO2 follows not from just Australian emission, not even from worldwide human emission. It follows collectively from all sources and sinks, human and natural. And that's what we're going to discuss. I was drawn to this topic, not naturally, but out of necessity. After relocating to Australia, I found myself waiting for resources. Eventually, I decided, well, I better do something. So I undertook the production of a new book. Now, as these things go, a book never proceeds as quickly as one would like, because when it comes to putting pen to paper, one finds that the understanding of key issues is inadequate. And on this subject, one of the most conspicuous is the evolution of CO2. This panel encapsulates our view of how CO2 has changed. Plotted in green is proxy CO2 in ice from a core over Antarctica. It's thought to represent CO2 that was previously in the atmosphere when that compressed snow fell. Now, CO2 is measured in units of parts per million by volume. 1 ppmv means that out of every million air molecules, one is a CO2 molecule. From the 19th century, CO2 increases steadily to the 1960s, when actual atmospheric observations began. Current values are about 380 ppmv. In red is the so-called delta 13, the relative concentration of the two isotopes, carbon 13 to carbon 12. On Earth, 99% of all carbon atoms have a molecular weight of 12, but 1% have an additional neutron, which gives them a molecular weight of 13. It turns out that because photosynthesis is more efficient with the lighter form of carbon, vegetation prefers carbon 12 over carbon 13. We'll revisit that in a moment. The relative concentration of carbon 13, that's the red curve, evidences a decline, which mirrors the increase of CO2. Together, these proxy records comprise the smoking gun of human emission. For reasons just seen, vegetation is slightly leaner in carbon 13 than the atmosphere. So is its ancestor, fossil fuel. Coal and oil each derive from ancient vegetation. Emission from combustion of fossil fuel therefore adds CO2 to the atmosphere, enriching atmospheric CO2. That's the green curve. The CO2 added, however, is leaner in carbon 13 than the atmosphere, thereby diluting its concentration in the atmosphere. That's the red curve. The glove fits. In truth, however, it's but one finger. Combustion of fossil fuel is one of many sources of CO2. Other sources involve a wide range of natural processes. Many are poorly documented. The historical interpretation is that opposite changes of CO2 and carbon 13, the green and the red curves, are the signature of human emission. For this interpretation to be valid, other sources of CO2, natural sources, must have the same concentration of carbon 13 as the atmosphere, which would then be left unchanged. That is, CO2 emitted by natural sources must not dilute carbon 13 in the atmosphere. The observed increase of CO2 and decrease of carbon 13 can then follow only from the human source. In reality, our knowledge of natural sources is limited. The little we do know is that natural sources are dynamic. They depend intrinsically on environmental conditions, cloud, moisture, temperature, even on the prevailing ecosystem. Why should we care? This is the estimated contribution from all sources. The human source is of order 5. It helps if you hold it the right way. 5 gigatons per year. By comparison, the ocean emits of order 90. Land emits of order another 60. Total emission from natural sources is thus of order 150 gigatons per year. It's approximately balanced by natural sinks, which absorb about as much. The key word, approximately, because natural sources and sinks are two orders of magnitude stronger, even a minor imbalance can overshadow the human source. Moreover, if those sources involve carbon 13, leaner than in the atmosphere, as many do, all bets are off. In truth, only one component of the CO2 budget is known with any certainty: human emission, implicitly through records of extraction, how much coal and oil are dug up. The rest, about 96%, is vaporware. It remains largely obscure. We have only isolated field measurements. That's because many of the responsible processes operate beneath the Earth's surface, beyond the grasp of global observation by satellite. They leave the dominant sources and sinks, the big arrows, not sharp, but fuzzy. If they change, we haven't the observations to know, at least not directly. Fortunately, we don't care. What's relevant is net emission, that collected from all sources and sinks, human and natural. That's what ultimately controls atmospheric CO2. Net emission is just the sum of the CO2 added from all sources minus the sum of the CO2 removed by all sinks. It, in turn, is proportional to the growth rate of global mean or globally average CO2. That is, the rate at which CO2 increases averaged over the Earth. So the net emission rate essentially controls how quickly CO2 increases averaged around the Earth. Now, once CO2 is produced, CO2 is produced and destroyed at the Earth's surface. But once it enters the atmosphere, it's inert. CO2 is therefore efficiently mixed by the atmospheric circulation, homogenized like cream stirred into your coffee. This is the global distribution of CO2, only recently available from satellites. Even these modern observations are limited to continents, but that's where the human source is. Large values, in yellow and red, are a signature of source regions. Notice, they're not found in the industrialized centers, the Ohio River Valley of the U.S., Northern Europe, not even China. Rather, they appear over the Amazon basin, tropical Africa, and Southeast Asia. Those regions have little human population, let alone industrialization. What I really want you to notice is that even in those source regions, CO2 deviates from its global mean by less than 5%. That's a good thing, because it means that local values are a good approximation of the global average, which in turn provides a record of net global emission. In fact, we have a long record of CO2 from only one site, Mauna Loa, Hawaii. The local record for Mauna Loa therefore approximates the global mean, which through its growth rate chronicles the history of net global emission, collectively from all sources, human and natural. And here it is. This is the instrumental record of CO2 from Mauna Loa. It's characterized by a conspicuous trend. That's what you saw earlier in the ice proxy. Superimposed on the trend is a small, innocuous annual variation, which has been largely ignored. You may recall the film Men in Black, in which there was a small canine character named Frank, whose size was overshadowed by his persona. He said, and I quote, "Humans think if something's important, it must be big. The galaxy is tiny, like a marble." Well, maybe Frank had something. This is the mean annual variation. CO2 increases during some months when sources prevail over sinks. More CO2 is then added than removed. It decreases during other months when sinks prevail over sources. More CO2 is then removed than added. But the variation isn't cyclic. More CO2 is emitted during some months of the year than is absorbed during others. This leaves a net change. CO2 in one January is 1.5 ppmv higher than CO2 in the preceding January. It represents the annual increment to the trend. Each year, CO2 picks up another 1.5 ppmv. Now, this is just the average picture. Here's the collection of all annual variations. Emission and absorption vary between years widely. So then does net annual emission, highlighted in blue. In some years, it increases by 100%. In others, it decreases to almost zero. These features of the instrumental record establish the following fundamental characteristics of atmospheric CO2. One, the trend is inexorably intertwined with the annual variation. Two, net annual emission, that is the annual increment to the trend, is a small residual between seasonal emission and absorption. And three, changes of net annual emission are large as the mean annual increment to the trend. Therefore, it would be a good idea to understand them. The difficulty is that CO2 emission is coupled to other properties of climate. A change in one induces changes in other climate properties. Ideally, we'd evaluate how net emission of CO2 changes through a controlled experiment, wherein we perturb the climate system in a known way and observe its response. Unfortunately, we haven't that capacity. Only one party can perform that experiment, Mother Nature. And she has. For over three decades, the Earth atmosphere system has been observed globally by satellites. The satellite record is now long enough to have collected a population of climate perturbations wherein the Earth atmosphere system was disturbed from equilibrium. Those events reveal how perturbations in one climate property influence others, including net emission of CO2. to explore the large changes of net emission, we filtered the CO2 record to changes that operate on timescales of 2 years and longer. The respective growth rate, that is the rate at which CO2 increases, then chronicles the history of net global emission. It's plotted in green. Net annual emission has an average of about 1.5 ppmv per year. We're on the right planet. That's the average annual increase you just saw. But it varies between years dramatically, by over 100%, from nearly zero in some years to almost 3 ppmv per year in others. Do I need to tell you that human emission doesn't do anything like this? Plotted in red, human emission increased smoothly. It mirrors the growth of human population, with deviations of only a couple of percent. By contrast, observed deviations of net emission exceed 100%. They are uncorrelated with human emission. That is, net global emission of CO2 changes independently of the human contribution. The record of net emission does, however, resemble surface properties of the general circulation. During 1991-92, net emission decreased by 70%. It gradually rebounded over the following 3 years. That episode coincides with the eruption of Mount Pinatubo, which decreased global temperature in the same fashion. During 1997-98, net emission increased by 200%. That episode coincides with the El Nino then, which increased global temperature. The correspondence during these events indicates that net emission is shaped by internal properties of the climate system, which characterize the general circulation. The observed correspondence is in fact consistent with field measurements of CO2 emission. They reveal strong sensitivity to temperature, supported over continent by soil moisture. An increase of either leads to increased emission of CO2 from natural sources. To get a handle on the behavior generally, we analyze the record of net emission, that's the green curve, in terms of global temperature from the satellite MSU and soil moisture from climate analyses. Those surface properties regulate emission of CO2 from natural sources. In blue is the respective component of net emission, the part that operates coherently with the general circulation, that is dependently on it, but incoherently with human emission. Although it accounts for only two key properties, the natural component closely tracks observed emission. It achieves a correlation to the observed record of 0.93, accounting for nearly all of the history of net global emission. Most of the dependence comes from temperature alone, which achieves a correlation of 0.8. The same analysis has been performed on delta 13, the relative concentration of carbon 13. Observed emission of carbon 13 is displayed in red. It has a mean that's negative, consistent with the decline of carbon 13 that you saw earlier. But like CO2, it varies dramatically by more than 100%. In blue is the part that operates coherently with the general circulation, but incoherently with human emission. Like CO2, it varies coherently with observed emission of carbon 13, just opposite. When temperature increases, emission of carbon 13 decreases, and vice versa. Likewise, when CO2 emission increases, that's the green curve, carbon 13 emission decreases, that's the red curve. Does this ring a bell? Remember the smoking gun? Opposite changes of CO2 and carbon 13 are the same ones in the ice proxy. The latter is regarded as a signature of human emission. But in the satellite record, the changes are clearly not from human emission. not unless you believe that human emission causes volcanic eruptions in El Nino. The blue curves are the first approximation, just temperature. They describe the component of net emission that operates coherently with the general circulation, but incoherently with human emission. Those curves embody the sensitivity of CO2 emission, how much net emission of CO2 is increased by an increase of temperature or soil moisture. Because they are incoherent with human emission, the blue curves and related sensitivity are represented only, can represent only emission from natural sources. If we know that component of net emission, we can add it from 1 year to the next year and so forth. The total then represents the contribution to observed CO2 from natural sources. In blue is the circulation-dependent component of CO2, the part introduced by natural sources. It's determined entirely by temperature and soil moisture. In green is the observed monthly record of CO2 from Mauna Loa. At the bottom is the circulation-dependent component of Delta 13, the part introduced by natural sources. It, too, is determined entirely by temperature and soil moisture. In red is the observed monthly record. The two components from natural sources evolve in opposite directions, just like the ice proxies of CO2 and carbon 13. Now, in principle, the sensitivity of emission observed during the satellite era enables the analysis to be extended backward to earlier years, in fact, over the entire 20th century. But before the satellite era, global observations are lacking. Nonetheless, most of the sensitivity of net emission comes from temperature alone. Global temperature before the satellite era is estimated from surface thermometers. They provide only partial coverage of the Earth over land near centers of population. But that's all we have. In blue is the circulation-dependent component of CO2, the part from natural sources, again derived from the satellite record, but now determined only from temperature, no soil moisture. As before, the natural component tracks the observed record of CO2, which is superimposed in green. In black is the same information, but now based on the surface estimate of global temperature, thermometers. The sampling uncertainty from that estimate is shaded. The black curve falls from just two things: the sensitivity of emission observed during the satellite era and the record of global temperature. Representing natural emission, it too tracks observed CO2 during the satellite era. In fact, it tracks it throughout the instrumental era, back to 1960 when atmospheric observations began. Observed CO2, that's the green curve, and the natural component, that's the black curve, then both approach 300 ppmv. Before 1960, the natural component continues to decrease, approaching 275 ppmv in 1880. The uncertainty, which increases backward, is then wide, ranging between 220 and 330 ppmv. Now, during this early period, observations of atmospheric CO2 are non-existent. We have only proxy CO2. In green is the ice proxy you saw at the start. It too decreases backward, approaching 290 ppmv in 1880. The modest discrepancy that develops before 1940, about 10 ppmv, lies well within the sampling uncertainty of surface measurements. But in light of the agreement during the instrumental era, the last half century, it may actually reflect error in the ice proxy of CO2. It may also reflect limitations of the surface network. At the bottom is coverage of the Earth by surface thermometers. It maximizes near 1960 at 35%. That's how much of the Earth is land. before 1960, coverage plummets. By 1880, coverage of the Earth by the surface network is less than 8%. From the observed behavior, it's clear that net global emission of CO2 depends intrinsically on temperature. Human emission does not. Plotted here is a proxy reconstruction of global temperature. It's one of many such reconstructions. Like proxy CO2, proxies of temperature disagree in many respects, but they share two major features. Between the years 900 and 1300, global temperature was anomalously warm. Known as the medieval warm period, this excursion of climate is chronicled in anecdotal evidence, the most familiar being the Norse colonization of Greenland. Between 1400 and 1800, global temperature was anomalously cold. Known as the Little Ice Age, it too is chronicled in anecdotal evidence, including chronic freezing of the Thames and New York Harbor. Since then, global temperature has been increasing. A pivotal issue is just how much of the modest warming during the 20th century is accounted for by the rebound from the Little Ice Age. That issue remains under debate. The observed behavior of CO2 shows that, regardless of how much, this warming must be attended by an increase of CO2 emission. That's what you saw in the contribution from natural sources. What the observed behavior reveals is a large, but hitherto invisible, elephant in the room. Remember the budget of CO2? You just thought it was CO2. It's really something with which you're more familiar, your monthly household budget. See the little red arrow? That credit is the varying interest on your bank account. Now, if your bank account's like mine, it's not a big player. See the big red arrow? That credit is your variable earnings. Unlike me, you work on commission. That's why you earn more. And like your bank interest, it varies from one month to the next. Anyone want to guess what is the large debit, the big green arrow? Oh, come on. What's the biggest drain on your monthly budget? That's right, your variable mortgage. What I've presented today is your net income. The presumption has been that it equals your bank interest. That presumption follows by balancing your checkbook with only 5% of the entries. Bank interest. Guess what? Your net income doesn't behave like your bank interest. It behaves like the difference between your variable earnings and your variable mortgage. The correspondence to observed changes of CO2 on timescales of a couple of years over the satellite era and to the degree seen even over the 20th century makes it difficult not to conclude that sources involved in changes of CO2 on short timescales are also involved in its change on long timescales. The popularized view has been that CO2 is driving the bus and climate is along for the ride. The observed behavior reveals just the reverse. Climate is at the wheel, and to a significant degree, CO2 is at the back of the bus. Climate projections rely on an ability to predict CO2. It's the one thing believed to be known. Because of the presumption, we control it. Namely, future atmospheric CO2 is determined entirely by human emission. That's what is specified in climate models, which then predict how climate will respond in so-called climate scenarios. The observed behavior reveals that, much as we might like it, the real world doesn't work that way. Net emission includes a substantial contribution from natural sources. If you don't control CO2, you can't predict it. And if you can't predict CO2, you can hardly predict how climate will respond. The climate modeling framework just described is the cornerstone of the IPCC, the UN's Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. I used to be a reviewer. Much of the public debate stems from the IPCC's last report. The behavior you've seen was not known at the time of that report. Were it, the IPCC could not have drawn the sweeping conclusions that it did. Here's why. As you've seen, emission from natural sources is integral to observed changes of CO2. Its contribution hasn't been recognized, nor is it represented in climate models. Because it involves emission other than human, that is, not solely human, future atmospheric CO2 is only marginally predictable and, in significant part, not controllable. That means that changes of human emission will not be tracked by changes of atmospheric CO2. They never have been. I'll close on a philosophical note. When I hear politicians speak on this fashionable topic and cite the science, as do those of a certain bent, it stimulates my involuntary gag reflex. There is no such thing. Science is dynamic. It's predicated on discourse, questioning. That's how we get to the truth. Were it not for discourse, we'd still be in the dark ages. Excluding discourse from the equation isn't science. It's advocacy. And if it's from an advocate, you hope to understand nature and how it will evolve. Pick up your phone and call Canberra. There are thousands of them. Beyond what you've seen today, and irrespective of how much of it you've grasped, there is one thing, one overarching theme that this audience should carry forward with unanimity. Anyone who thinks the science of this complex system is settled is in fantasia. Thank you.
Many thanks to Professor Selby. Thanks to CAUSE Chambers Westgarth for providing this facility at short notice today. We're very grateful. I think we can have the lights up now, can't we? Because we've finished with our display. I'm not a scientist. I'll just lead off and take up one of your points at the end. What you seem to be saying to me is that what comes out of a model is essentially what you put in it. So you're querying some of what the material that's put into the models that leads to the report that comes from the IPCC. Is that so what's your exact point on models? You come back here and talk down there.
Well, any model that you construct, especially a complex model, operates within the framework that you devise it, because you can't include everything in a model. So what you do in the development of any model is to essentially articulate the model and bring it closer and closer to reality, and you have observations that validate the model. They anchor it. So as you build it a little more complex, it's got to satisfy this observed constraint, it's got to satisfy this observed constraint, and so forth. Well, what I've shown you today is a rather central observed constraint, namely the relationship between observed changes of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere and their dependence on a rather rudimentary climate property, global temperature and soil moisture. And that establishes a pretty important sensitivity, and it is not represented in models. And if it were, you would end up producing about twice the observed increase of CO2. And I'll let you ponder what that means for the subsequent predictions of temperature.
Let me go, but I think in your CV, did you have some involvement with NASA?
I've worked with NASA.
And how did that fit in with your work, and why are you not there now?
So the question is, did you have any involvement with NASA, and how does that fit in your work, and why are you no longer at NASA?
Well, I never was at NASA, so that's a good answer for that one. I've worked with NASA and different satellites for years and their research projects and whatever, collaborators, and I still have collaborators there, and I saw quite a few of them at this international conference that I quoted before. So are you asking me why I'm here?
Well, I'm wondering whether that has something to do with your interest in satellites and your discovery of, you spoke about being an agnostic and changing your views over time.
Well, I think that's part of science, right? If you're open-minded, you should always see new information and new perspectives. And I can tell you, I got a letter or a message from a colleague of mine at the U.S. National Center for Atmospheric Research after this meeting where I presented this material. And it read as follows: your presentation really created a stir. So, I mean, the point of science is that you should think critically and think. And you gradually iterate and converge to the truth in that process. The problem is if you stop questioning, you stop thinking critically, you don't move forward.
Well, going on back to Greg, before I do, just tell us a little bit about the conference you addressed, because that's what Tom Parker told us about. You were talking at this conference, so, and how was your paper received?
Well, the paper, I think, came as a shock to most of the people because it is something that no one has really thought about.
And I gather it was the subject of discussion for some time. I've gotten some comments back on the paper, and I know who the reviewer is. He's actually a top person in the field, and he characterized the results as amazing. So I think that this is something that people are going to have to do a lot of thinking about because, let me put it in perspective. So much of the attention is focused on the human source that implicitly the other 150, the big arrows, have been presumed to pretty much not only cancel, but to be static. That is, they're sitting on the sidelines with their arms folded and their legs crossed while all this other stuff is going on. And if you look at the field measurements, they don't do that at all. They're dynamic. They are coupled to all of these parameters. So if you change some of the features, you're going to invariably end up changing those. And what these results point to is the very strong sensitivity to temperature.
Now, we're going to Greg, but I've got a microphone here, but I don't want to walk in front of the camera. So can you just...
There seems to be a panel or a circuit of scientists that you hear all the time on this topic, mostly on my side of I haven't heard of you doing this before. Is this because it's so recent? And I'm just wondering if you are now going to get on the circuit and tell people, is there any set of invitations starting to come in? Or how does this process work so far as you know?
Well, I'm afraid that your question is too amorphous for me to be able to respond because I don't know which panel of which of these extremes you're referring to. I don't like extremes, and I think when you get too extreme, you sort of lose sight, you get blinders. I think you have to be open-minded, and I would not rule out that someone will come up with another interpretation other than the obvious one, but I'll tell you this. I sat on these results for a year, and I turned the crank of my bicycle many revolutions before I went forward and presented them. And I gave it to a couple of people in the field whose interpretive skills I value, I regard highly, senior people. And they sat on it for half a year and scratched their head and had as much of a shock reaction as I did. And thus far, no one has come up with a viable alternative interpretation. I wouldn't rule it out because unlike some characters, I'm open. What do you got in mind? But so far, that's what we have.
Over here. Forgive me, Barry, I'm not a scientist, but it seems to me that...
I won't hold it against you.
In recent times, it seems to me that the debate has shifted towards the question of climate sensitivity, even for the non-scientific community. I think that's recognisable. To what extent has the scientific community not grappled with the whole question of the signature of human emissions in the difference between C12 and C13, because I've never heard of this before. And
well, the carbon-12, carbon-13 is intrinsic to the current interpretation that changes of CO2 are due to human emission. Okay? That's legacy at this point. But no one has looked carefully. Now, as a colleague of mine at MIT said when he saw these results, someone should have done some serious checking. So what I've shown you is that you say out of phase, opposite changes between CO2 going one way and C13 going the other way, is not unique to human emission. It is, in fact, endemic to the big part of your household budget. Did I answer your question?
Just wondering about the effect of deforestation on soil moisture and climate change, and whether that will alter carbon emissions.
Question about the effect of deforestation.
Well, I wouldn't make a prediction. There used to be an Italian spaghetti sauce called ragu, and everything was, it's in there. So when you look at the net emission, basically it's the collection of all of these sources. Right? Sorry, I can't be more definitive.
No, it just seems that there has been a large degree of deforestation across the ecosystem.
There it is.
We don't have a microphone now. Yes?
Alan Robinson, Professor, thank you. Thank you very much for the research that you've done. What you've done and the way you presented it is extraordinarily persuasive, I have to say. But I've got to say, now I can understand why the Prime Minister and Climate Change Minister didn't go to all that stuff and try and explain it to people, because it's very hard to explain in context. That said, is our carbon tax likely to have any impact on this at all?
The duty of a scientist is not to instruct the public what it should do. That's the work of an advocate, perhaps masquerading as a scientist. A scientist's duty is to equip the public with physical insight into reality.
And the reality is, we'll make no difference.
I showed you the observed changes of carbon dioxide, and I showed you the part that is accounted for by emission from natural sources. The difference between those two is where the impact from human emission can fall. And I'll let you judge what that is.
We've got a question over here, then we go down the back to Greg.
Chris goes, I've heard it said that Australia, because it has a very small population, large country, it's a very large country of water, in fact, is a greater carbon sink than emitter of natural causes. In fact, we should be the one country, because we are in that position, not implementing a carbon tax, because we basically absorb more carbon dioxide in the world than any other country other than we emit. So I was wondering if you just comment on that fact. Is that most as wrong?
Well, that falls in the crack between what's accounted for by the natural sources, of which you have little, if any, control, and the observed net emission. And like I said, I'll let you judge from how big that is.
Get on the back with Jeff. Yes. Can you speak up a bit? Yes, speak up.
Is your paper available on the web? First of all, what was the conference you gave it at? And I think that question was asked before. I'm not sure you answered it. And is your paper available on the web?
Okay, the conference is a very large earth sciences conference, probably the largest in the world. It happened to be held in Melbourne. It's called the IUGG, the International Union of Geophysics and Geodesy. And it was presented there. About half of the material I presented here will appear in about 6 weeks in the book. And the other half will probably not appear before the first part of 2012. In the publication process and schedule.
There's a question over there. I can't get the microphone. So, yeah.
We've heard that if the global temperature rises 4 degrees, we will have significant problems in drought and other things. What do you predict? Because you predict that increases in global temperature increase the level of CO2, and I think the level of CO2 increases the global temperature. So if natural things are pushing global temperatures up, what temperature do you think we're going to get to by your projections and from the study you've done?
Well, I don't do any projections. That's not my business. But the 4 degrees that you just quoted is essentially a model extrapolation based on the framework that I described. So what you've pointed to, that, you know, if temperature increases continually, then you get increased CO2. And it represents a positive feedback, more temperature, more CO2. And if you think that the CO2 is responsible for that temperature, then it would accelerate. But for reasons that I'm not going to go into with this audience, there has to be a negative feedback that bridles this positive feedback and holds things in check. Let me make one comment. I mean, what you're really talking about is a four-degree simulation, right? And that's based on model runs that were done, in the late 90s and early 2000s for the last IPCC report. Now, the conclusion of that was that the increased temperature that was observed, global temperature, during the 80s and the 90s, was due to CO2. And that appears to have been a sucker punch that the IPCC went for, because no sooner, the ink hadn't even dried on the report, than Mother Nature intervened. And CO2, after the turn of the century, continued to increase. In fact, if anything, slightly faster. But global temperature didn't. If anything, it decreased in the first decade of the 21st century. Now, I'm confident the IPCC will come up with an explanation. In fact, it's already come up with several. But your extrapolation of 4 degrees presumes that you essentially have these model projections. And that's what they're relying on. And those model projections rely on, we know what CO2 is, since we're responsible for CO2, since the human source is essentially what causes atmospheric CO2 to change, quote unquote, and we can extrapolate that. Well, doesn't look like that works. Did I answer your question?
The question here? Yeah. Don't stand up here.
Murray,
Peter.
I think that the contribution of anthropogenic footprint on the Earth system to the natural sources could be larger than 5% over the industrial period.
So are you asking the current, whether this should not be a 5, maybe a 10, or a 15, or a 20?
No, the human sources, I thought that was just from fossil fuel burning as opposed to changes in natural ecosystems driven by the expanding population of the world.
Yeah. Beats me. I think what Peter is raising is that this 5 really represents the emission due to fossil fuel consumption. And there's some other more subtle impacts that are very difficult, if even possible, to document. Changes of landscape, vegetation, and so forth. And all I know is that it is in the net, but trying to discriminate those, we can't do it now. I'm not sure we can ever do it.
Okay, well, right down the back, let me come up here and over here.
Professor, it's 40 years since I left the physics department of your university, so you'll forgive me. But as I understand it, your paper has not yet been fully exposed to that scientific rigor that you quite rightly endorse. Or have I misunderstood it? The moment your paper has been presented to a conference, it will be published in the near future, but as yet has not been fully open to the scientific rigor that would happen once your paper is fully published. Have I understood that correctly?
Not quite. It's already passed through the review process.
At the conference?
No. Journal level.
At journal level, but it hasn't been exposed to the full...
These are new results. Right. I just now released them at this conference.
Thanks.
Okay, so we've got a question here, then we're going out to here.
Methane, which is considered, depending on who you read, 20 to 30 times more toxic. Where does that fit into the equation? Because that's, you know, the whole debate that we're hearing on the political front is about high CO2, and we never hear about anything else.
Good question. Well, methane is not toxic, but it is a greenhouse gas, like CO2, and like water vapor. And a very interesting thing turns out. The anthropogenic source of methane is largely unrelated to the anthropogenic source of CO2, unless you believe that combustion stimulates bovine flatulence or something. But the natural sources of methane are, in fact, the same as the natural sources of CO2. Guess what? Net emission of methane has the same dependence on properties of the general circulation as net emission of CO2.
Well, it's over 60 years since I was in the physics department at Sydney University. Anyway, the isotope C13, what molecule is that in? Secondly, just as methane, is that CH4? Methane
is CH4.
Yeah. Okay, so the isotope C13 with the extra neutron, what molecule? Like, we have CO2.
Well, when we're talking about atmospheric carbon-13, they're talking about CO2 principally. Because CO2, the other carbon molecule is methane, and it's so far down, orders of magnitude smaller. So most of it's coming from CO2.
Yeah.
Yes, I'm wondering if you trace the CO2 record back through the ice cores and so on. I think I'm right in saying that we've seen, or the Earth has seen, CO2 increasing and then decreasing and increasing again. And it's presumably to do with the sort of mechanism that you're talking about, when on some occasions you have a net positive emission versus the sink. And then somehow the whole process would seem to reverse itself. Have you got any thoughts as to what might be causing that? I mean, you talked about temperatures and moisture, but that doesn't really explain why we have these cycles, or the cycles that occurred.
Well, you're asking. I think you're asking what causes the ice ages. Is that?
Well, what's if we look at this on your trends, you'd think, well, the CO2 trend through natural causes would increase continuously. But presumably at some point, based on what we know about the history, it will reverse itself. So,
well, it will level off.
As to why that might be, if I'm on the right track.
Well, if I understand your question, I think what you're asking is how long would you expect this relationship to prevail? For example, the mechanisms that are responsible for the emission absorption might eventually saturate. So you get this relationship, it applies for a couple of years, maybe it applies for 10 years, maybe it applies longer. But eventually, if you go back far enough, presumably something happens where it breaks down. And so what we can say is that it's still valid over three decades, the length of the satellite era, and to the degree that you saw, it appears to be still approximately valid on the timescale of a century. Now, if you go back 50,000 years, I wouldn't hold out any hope on it. But I should also say that I think it's a pitfall that people look at the ice proxy of CO2 and take it literally. It's not atmospheric CO2. And I don't believe it's even CO2 that was in the atmosphere when that piece of snow was laid down. You know, it's one thing you have essentially in the last 50 years, you can look at some CO2 in that ice. But if you look at the snow that was laid down 50,000 years ago, that's a long time. And it's a long time for the molecules to sit there and remain and not be diffused between adjacent layers. If you look carefully at the ice proxy record, what you find is that at the highest levels, the nearest time, you can see these short-term fluctuations, high-frequency fluctuations. But as you go deeper into the ice, to earlier periods, they get blurred out, they get filtered out, and you don't see them at all. So what you're looking at at any one of these levels in the deeper ice core, it certainly has to be some mixture of CO2 at this level and adjacent levels. And that is one of the major ambiguities surrounding proxy CO2 in ice.
You're saying that human sources are small compared with natural sources. Now, on that diagram for the ocean, you've got a huge plus and a huge minus. Please explain, if you just took the net, be comparable to human sources.
Well, exactly. That's the point. By the way, this isn't my diagram. This is the IPCC's diagram. So this is their best estimate. And, you know, as I said, the only component of this that is nailed down with any certainty is the human part. The rest is, I hope it's better than an order of magnitude analysis, but it gives you an idea of the comparative size of these terms. And so, if these two big arrows are perfectly in balance, then your bank interest controls your net income. But if they're not, there's more to the story.
Right down the back, final question, Jeff.
Would your findings be consistent with the criticism made of Al Gore's movie when he
The short answer is yes, but I don't know that it's the same mechanism. So what the gentleman just pointed out is if you look in the ice proxy, and if you take my advice that you don't take it literally, then you see fluctuations of temperature and fluctuations of CO2. And just a historical note, that the guy who started this was a Swedish chemist whose lab I used to work at in Stockholm by the name of Arrhenius. He won the Nobel Prize for chemistry, and his understanding of actually temperature dependence of chemical reactions got him the Nobel Prize. He got into this, and he started the whole global warming thing because he was actually trying to explain ice ages. And he saw CO2 varied and temperature varied, so he figured, well, maybe CO2 caused the ice ages. Now, I don't think anyone believes that anymore. But if you look carefully at those variations, you find that first the temperature changes, and then the CO2 changes. And it has the same kind of relationship that you see here on contemporary timescales, and undoubtedly involves some of the same mechanisms. But I wouldn't make a statement that what I've shown you today that applies on yearly, decadal, and even centennial timescales is the same thing that you're seeing on timescales of 100,000 years.
Many thanks. So we didn't just stay there. I'll be very, very brief. Once again, thanks to Tom Parker, one of our members here, for pointing us to Professor Selby. I think tonight we've had an important night, an important paper. The Sydney Institute is fully committed to debate and discussion, and I'm pleased that our speaker is too. We've had a number of discussions here from qualified people on the issue of the general climate debate. We'll have more in the future. But tonight, I think, was a very important night, and we look forward to the publication of the paper in due course. But thanks for coming along tonight. Thanks for saying something significant at the Sydney Institute, and I'm sure this paper is going to be quoted quite a lot in the future. And for that, well done, and we're grateful. Thank you.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.